Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A surging China was a huge enabler of American boom times, with billions to lend and boatloads of goods to fill the store shelves. It's also been a rising challenge to the American view of human rights and global order. Now the U.S. is in economic trouble, and so is China. Cargo ships leaving half empty, factories closing, the future a little less clear. But the U.S. still needs China, and China needs us. This hour, On Point, China's next move. A special welcome today to new listeners on WUOTHD2 in Knoxville, Tennessee. We're glad you're with us. We've got a great crew with us today from across the Pacific. From Beijing, Anthony Kuhn, correspondent there for National Public Radio, is with us. Anthony, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be back with you.
Wonderful to have you. From the Marketplace studio in Shanghai is James Arity, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We saw him in Shanghai in April. James, great to have you with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for the invitation.
And from Shanghai, for a big-picture Chinese perspective, we're joined by Shen-Ding Li, professor and executive director at Fudan University's Institute of International Studies, a big voice in China. Dr. Shen, welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you with us again as well.
Very nice to talk to you again.
James Arity, first to you. Give us a snapshot of what's going on with the Chinese economy. They're predicting growth that's much bigger than American growth in the year ahead, and yet not what they've had. What's happening on the economic front?
Well, there's been a sudden turn in the Chinese economy, and it's in a direction that few could have forecast even a year ago. China is quite clearly tethered to the world economy, and it's starting to see exports go through the floor. As you said, we're starting to see factories close. We're starting to see people lose their jobs as they're being fired rather than quitting and joining a new company where they would make more money. This is really unprecedented times for the Chinese economy in recent years.
Anthony, you're watching from Beijing. How big a shock is it to Chinese workers to see, you know, themselves in the millions out of work? It's been a long sort of a long up time for China, and now this hiccup, burp, I don't know what to call it. Are people really upset by it? Are they taking it in stride? What's the response been?
Well, yes, it has been a long up, Tom. If you think about it, really, it marks perhaps the beginning of the end of an era. For the past 30 years, China has been operating these export processing platforms in the Pearl River Delta in the south and the Yangtze River Delta near Shanghai, and I think this signals that gradually they're going to move away from this model of economic growth. In the short term, what you see if you go down to these places is you go to the train stations and the bus stations, and the millions of migrant workers who come from the countryside to these factories to make the things that we buy are now heading home early for the Chinese New Year, which actually falls at the end of January this year. So in a way, it's masked by the fact that there is this annual migration, and they're all heading home anyway. So the real crunch will happen, I think, after the Chinese New Year in February, when they come back to the coastal export enclaves, they look for the jobs, and they find they're not there. And believe me, that has the government very worried, and that's why they've turned around their economic policy. Before, their main concern was inflation. Now it is employment.
Professor Shen, Shen-Ding Li in Shanghai. How about it? China is looking forward to its Lunar New Year at the end of January. The Year of the Ox is coming up. It's 30 years since Deng Xiaoping gave the famous speech in the South that sort of opened the door to communism with Chinese characteristics, or what really looks like market capitalism in many ways. The world has come to see China on a kind of, nonstop course to greater and greater standing and status. What do you think is happening here? Is China's great surge over? Is it just taking a pause? Does it have to change radically? What is this moment for China, Dr. Shen?
Well, actually, there is a complex picture here.
Mm-hmm.
Given China's opening and interaction with America, cooperating in economic and in many other areas, U.S. and China have very strong interdependence. America outsources Chinese labor. It's a cheap labor to produce good quality stuff for American people to purchase. And that has also enriched China as well as an outcome after China's opening for 30 years. China has probably by the end of last year has reaped an annual GDP at probably $4 trillion. This might be one quarter of America. And when we talk about China's rising standing, China is only one quarter of America. And when we see how many people in China we have, it's 1.3 billion people. It's basically 4 or 5 times more than America. Therefore, China's per capita GDP is only 5% of America. We see a complex picture. China is rising, probably has surpassed Germany by the end of last year to be the number three, the third biggest economy in the world. But China's per capita GDP is still less than $3,000. It's a very poor country by any standard. Therefore, we see poor average performance, but quite competitive and ever-rising overall competence for this country. It's very complex.
James Arity, when we were in Shanghai in April, we talked with people who said it's going to take 30 or 40 years for us to reach equivalence with Western affluence. But China, are going to do that, whatever it takes. Do you still see China with that kind of optimism and ambition? Has this economic setback changed that, or is it just changing the way people are thinking about how progress may occur, James?
Well, I think you're looking at a very rich country in many ways with a lot of poor people. And the only way that this country can move is to make those people wealthier, to do something to raise their incomes, to raise their living standards. And I think that you know, that they still have their eye on the ball. That goal has not changed one bit, I don't think. I think they are a little nervous about the economic model that they've been following. They've been looking very closely to the U.S. for guidance, for lots of advice. The U.S. has stumbled in a big way. The leader has stumbled. Where should the student go? But I think it's quite clear that the government wants to enrich its people, and I think that they do see opening up as the way to go. What they need to do is continue to draw foreign investors into this country. They need to build on something more sustainable than exporting more than they did yesterday. And hopefully the government is getting that message. I think that there is a bit of shock going on, and I'm not sure that they realize how they move forward. But I think that they do have their eye on the ball.
Anthony Kuhn, in Beijing, there has been a lot of talk in both countries about stimulus. China has rolled out its own stimulus package. Barack Obama is talking about, Democrats are talking about maybe $1 trillion stimulus when Obama comes to office later this month. And the presumption is that a lot of Chinese-held dollars will be involved. It will be lent to the United States to make that happen. Is there any doubt that China is there ready to lend and invest in the U.S. economic restart stimulus? Is there any question of that, Anthony?
Well, it depends how you look at it. I mean, the fact is they're already the largest holder of American corporate and government debt. And they have no plans to dump that immediately because, of course, that would see the value of their own holdings plummet. On the other hand, if you think they're going to rush to the rescue like a white knight with their $2 trillion in foreign exchange reserves and buy up all our distressed assets, well, that's not going to happen because they already have that money invested in U.S. Treasury bonds and Fannie and Freddie Mae, Fannie and Freddie securities. So they don't have that money to come to the rescue, even if they wanted to. And because their investments in the U.S., such as the private equity group Blackstone and Morgan Stanley, and the investments they've already made, haven't fared very well, I don't think they're going to be snapping up assets like crazy. But you know, as they've said here, their biggest contribution will be to keep their own economy running, and I think that's it's going to consume all of their efforts. And as far as stimulus packages are concerned, I think there are a lot of similarities if you look at some parts of the U.S. and Chinese stimulus packages, and that is the stimulus going to go to parts of the economy that need it? Are they going to, you know, help competitive parts of the economy, or are they going to go to lumbering, inefficient, state-owned enterprises, or we could even say nationalized enterprises? That's a big question. What they need to do is stimulate consumption, get Chinese to export less and consume more. And that's very hard to do in the short term. It's impossible, really, to turn around the nature of the economy from an export-driven economy to a consumption-driven economy in a very short period of time.
We've got a lot to look at here in this hour on the Chinese front. Anthony Kuhn in Beijing, James Arity and Shending Li in Shanghai, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. James Arity with The Wall Street Journal. Look at these numbers with us for a moment. Third quarter growth in China is supposed to be, looks like about 9%, which sounds very high by American standards, but down from almost 12% for the whole year of 2007. Anthony Kuhn says we may be at the beginning of the end of an era, the export era. Can China make that turn and keep the kind of growth it needs to throw off the big surpluses and have political stability and all the rest, James?
I mean, these are obviously the big questions. We're looking at a very quiet period in China right now. We're going into the Chinese New Year holidays. We've just come off Christmas. Believe it or not, it's actually a holiday of sorts in China, and certainly in terms of the way foreign companies interact with China. So we're probably going to see another very weak period in the fourth quarter and maybe in the first quarter of 2009. Where we go from there is the big question. Have people closed factories for on a temporary basis, or have the orders dried up forever? Is there going to be any, you know, renewal from the government, the way it's trying to kickstart its economy with a, you know, nearly $600 billion stimulus package? Mm-hmm. How much of that is new money? We really don't know the answers to these questions. Obviously, the world economy has turned so quickly everywhere, and China is now seeing it. Maybe there's a delayed reaction. But we do have to start looking at, you know, how China is going to react, not in the third quarter of 2008 or even the fourth quarter, but in the first and second quarter of this coming year.
Shending Li, how important is the American economy for China to get back to the level of growth that it would like to see? Can China recover without an American recovery?
Well, as China and U.S. have been interdependent very strongly, China depends upon Americans' demand of spending. That would make China to build, manufacture for America. Therefore, given this modality of relationship, when America has some difficulty in spending, Americans' need for other countries, especially for China's manufacturing for America, has reduced. And I think in short term, there will not be a replacement of such a demand from within China.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, as you have mentioned, China's economic production increase speed has been reduced from 11-12% to 8-9% lately. And I don't think we will have an ability to regain the previous momentum very quickly. And as we are dependent, we are more cooperating, but also both of us are mutually vulnerable given this interdependence.
Anthony Kuhn, can you explain for us why it has been a challenge for China to increase the consumption of its own consumers? Why has that been hard for Chinese consumers to do, for the government to encourage?
Well, it's a complex issue, but basically, first of all, China has never had a real consumer society in the sense that we understand it. First of all, it's a cash-based society. So you can bring interest rates down to zero and give away credit cards, mm-hmm. and many people will just not want to spend. The other thing is, of course, that the reason people squirrel away their money is because they are concerned about who's going to take care of them in their old age. A lot of them do not have Social Security. They're concerned about paying for their kids' education, and they're concerned about their hospital bills, their medical expenses. And even if they were to have all these safety nets put in place in a year, which, of course, is an impossible scenario, it would still take time, possibly years, for their thinking to turn around to the state where they'd want to spend money they had not yet earned, or even spend money that they had earned. So it's just very tough to get them to open their wallets right now.
James, I'm reading here a quote from the outspoken Minister of the Environment, the Vice Minister of the Ministry of Environment, Pan Yue, quoted in the People's Daily, the New York Times has him here, blaming Western excess for the current global crisis, warning that China risked ruin if it blindly pursued Western industrial models. And he says, writing this, "The present global economic crisis shows that if China continues down the old road of Western industrial civilization, it will only come to a dead end." Is that a widespread view, James? Is that Mr. Pan out on his own hook there? What do you make of that perspective?
There's been an enormous amount of criticism of Chinese government leaders and the people who are investing China's currency reserves. There is a widespread view among Netizens, people on the internet, blogging, making their views known, that China's government has lots of money and is spending it in all the wrong ways, that it's gotten just as caught up in the Wall Street travails as anyone in the U.S. And there's a sense that China is, you know, just listening to what is the U.S. government has been telling it to do. That is a view. And I'm not really sure what Mr. Pan is referring to specifically. But certainly there have been comments from government officials that seem to recognize that there is a lot of criticism about how closely tied China's economy has gotten to the U.S. and the world economy by holding treasury bills, by making investments in Wall Street banks and in banks and making investments in companies that are listed overseas, when some of those assets have depreciated far more quickly than even the Shanghai Stock Exchange, which lost nearly 70% last year.
So China's lost a lot of money, but the question is about the model it pursues going forward. I want to begin to turn to our listeners. Let's go to Phil in Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hello, folks. I want to follow up, actually, on that last comment about Chinese government purchasing U.S. Treasury bills.
Yes.
Quite frequently, the folks like you talk about foreign investment in the United States and recently said China is one of the United States' largest investors, and I'm curious on how much of that investment actually is by the government itself versus private investors versus free market capitalists. And on the other side of that coin, does the United States government similarly invest in other economies by buying their currency instruments?
We'll pick it up. We haven't had a lot of surplus to invest abroad. Anthony Kuhn, when we talk about China investing in the United States, you hear Phil's question, what are we talking about exactly? Is it mainly the Chinese government pouring cash into T-bills? And when it comes to the Blackstone Group and other specific investment purchases of shares in American companies, is that the Chinese government also or private investors?
Yes. Well, the main players, of course, is the central bank in China, and of course, the state-owned banks. There's only one private bank in China. All the others are state-owned. So it basically is a government policy, and it basically is state action. And what people have been wondering now is whether Chinese companies are going to start going to the U.S. and taking advantage of falling prices to snap up assets. And I think there's there's been a little bit of a phobia about, you know, Chinese buying away the Brooklyn Bridge, or a little bit the way people were afraid that the Japanese would come in the 80s and do the same. But I think there's a fair bit of trepidation, and certainly the government has said that they're going to be very circumspect, very much more cautious about buying assets in the U.S. than they might have been previously.
Shen Ding Li, overall, I think the United States has welcomed that flow of Chinese capital because it's underwritten so much of the borrowing here, for better and maybe for worse, in the U.S. Anthony Kuhn talked about how much China has already invested in the United States and T-bills and all the rest. Do you expect that flow of capital from China to keep coming to the United States, Professor Shen, or does it diminish now that China has economic problems?
Well, in the past, I think with the increase of Chinese government commanding of the U.S. dollar and the foreign currency, we need to invest. But you need to invest in those assured, secure place where we can make sure that our money would expand. Investing in China, and China needs investment. It would be natural that the Chinese would invest in China. But actually, China invests in America. The reason is simple. You need to invest in a place where technology would back the investment. And that's what we lack. So we lend money to America. And American lend money to China and with American technology. And then we ignore the risk, the vulnerability of the so-called American capitalist system. And we thought American is almighty, American is strong, and American is hardworking and innovative and great technology. How American would fail? I think for 20 years, we would never think about the possibility American would collapse or fail. This time, we failed to this. American is having difficulty. Therefore, people would challenge our government why we have been blinded to invest in America. I think my government is under pressure and lots of criticism of this. But strategical analysis, America is still the place that is more safe if we would invest somewhere. Because this crisis is short-term. It won't last for decades. It will be few months, a few years. And America has a huge amount of endowment. Thousands of universities and laboratory, they compete to develop new technology. And I think America would get recovered sooner or later. And then China would still invest, in my view. We would still find the secure place. And now we have the lesson. America is not guaranteed that it's always secure. Therefore, my government need to tell Chinese, I'm a responsible government. We would wait for a while to see the performance of an American government. Whether the American government has been responsible enough for their own people. So my leader has called the U.S. president to ask American leadership to guarantee that the Chinese investment in China is secure. And given this, I think the money would continue to flow to America, despite the current situation that our trade is having difficulty and our keeping of foreign currency reserve is a little shrinking. I think after waiting for a few months, we will make a quite proactive decision.
Shen Ding Li in Shanghai. James Arity, how do you see it rippling through Chinese policy going forward? That, as Shen Ding Li says, the U.S. is no longer a good thing. The thought was, how could America fail? Now America's had a pretty big stumble. How do you see that changing Chinese policy going forward, James?
Clearly, there have been missed opportunities on both sides. Perhaps China invested too quickly into the U.S., and the U.S. was relying too much on its financial system. Let's hope these mistakes aren't made again. I think that the Chinese government certainly would realize some of the needs that they need to put in, the structures that they need to put in place. And, you know, there are really two basic scenarios. One is that there is a called beggar thy neighbor approach to this, where China would try to do whatever it can to export its way out of problems, out of its problems, mm-hmm. to sort of double up on the problems that it's already had by, for example, lowering the rate of its currency.
Which it has already done to some extent.
To a minor degree. Mm-hmm. But in the big picture, a very small amount.
Okay.
But will they do things like invest in healthcare systems? Will they respond to people's protests? Will they allow more of a free press? Will they allow people to open businesses and small businesses in a way that are so prevalent in the Chinese world, but in mainland China, don't really exist because there's been such an emphasis on the state, and the big business is the only one that can grow the economy. I mean, I think that there are a lot of ways that the Chinese government can perhaps back off, that they can continue with their economic opening, grasp the benefits of the market economy, but don't necessarily make the mistakes of the past where some blind investment or relying too much on big companies and the state-directed way of doing things. We'll really see what sort of model they take. But I think that they probably understand it much better than I do, what they need to do, where the easy route or the more difficult route, and what would pay dividends in the long term. You know, China is hurting right now, but in the same way there aren't tumbleweeds blowing through the streets of Manhattan, mm-hmm. nor are they in China. I mean, there is still an enormous amount of business that's going on in China. It's just been a big shock in terms of, you know, if it keeps going like this, there will be big problems down the road.
Is there any sign of turnaround yet? Has their stimulus begun to kick in, James, or is it still in the offing?
I think that it'd be hard-pressed to say we've seen the bottom in the Chinese economy. I mean, I think that after the Chinese New Year, when we get a clearer picture of who's paying their bills, which factories are closing for good, which foreign investors are willing to come back here, and which have been turned off by the difficulty of doing business in China, we'll have a better idea. But certainly, I think it's too early to call a bottom in the Chinese economy, although we have seen some interesting things. We have seen a bit of a pickup in the local stock market. People are nibbling around the home market. The property market in China seems to be finding some buyers as the government works to cut interest rates and otherwise spur investment.
James Arity in Shanghai, Shen Dingli, Anthony Kuhn, please stand by. We're talking about China's next move in a troubled global economy, troubles on its own shores.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Let's go to Jeff in Andover, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Tom, I'd like you to put it to James in Shanghai, mm-hmm. to get his opinion on if Obama tried to reorder our relationship with China, say around the worker rights issue, and would start to fund some human rights groups and trade union groups in Hong Kong to go into the mainland and do some investigation about the wages being paid, about the complaints of workers, complete with brand names and factory addresses. I think this would go a long way to empowering Chinese workers, because I helped start the anti-sweatshop movement about 20 years ago, mm-hmm. from a little office in Indonesia, mm-hmm. and I know American consumers are concerned, and they can't go into a store, either a Main Street store or the Walmart, and get a hammer or a hair dryer or hip boots that aren't made in China. And mm-hmm. I think they'd like to help those workers get a leg up.
Jeff, let us pick it up. James, first to you. You hear the question. Is there room for Barack Obama, who's talked a lot about labor standards and trade agreements, to put more pressure on China? Or do the economics of this moment give the U.S. less leverage there?
The saying comes to mind, don't yell at your banker. I think that Barack Obama would have a very hard time taking forward a strategy like that. I think that that would probably be part of the dialogue with China. Certainly, that's what the U.S., many people in the U.S. would like to see, would be better working conditions. But we're talking right now, China is trying to make jobs for its people in the same way that the U.S. is trying to produce jobs for its people. The U.S.-China relationship is incredibly complicated. It's probably the most complex international relationship there is, and it's certainly the most important one, the most important bilateral relationship. It runs the gamut, military, security, politics, drugs, to human rights, to just trade. I mean, really, you name the subject, and there is some sort of U.S.-China dialogue. I think that, I mean, that's the issue, is it? It's quite a complex situation. And right now, I don't think that animosity is probably the best way to deal with the relationship, and I doubt that that's the way forward. Not only is the relationship complex, but it's also quite good, in fact. In many ways, I think the U.S. and the Chinese government do have a dialogue on all sorts of things. Neither one is completely satisfied on every issue, as upset as Americans would be about some of the factory conditions in China. Chinese will be upset about, you know, how their money invested in the U.S. is being spent.
Mm. Shendingly, I'm curious how you respond to our caller's concern about sweatshop conditions in China, working conditions there in general. You've spent time in the United States. You know that there are plenty of Americans would respond to that, would say, yes, we need China's labor conditions to be better. We don't want to send our jobs overseas to people who are low paid and working in dangerous circumstances. What are you thinking when you hear that line of criticism from Americans?
I think I understand the outcry, and I also understand that they want to have both cheap, priced, good quality stuff without hurting their job. Mm-hmm. They want to have their job, but at the same time, they want to benefit from those cheap, priced, good quality stuff. But this is a dilemma. When you have the latter, you will have the risk of losing job. Because America is a rich country, American workers are paid quite decently. Therefore, they are not able to produce good quality, cheaper priced products. Their products are good quality, but also not cheap. Therefore, you cannot do both. That would make American investors to find other places like China and India to outsource them. And previously, these resources are not available to America because of the ideological difference, the Cold War mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given the globalization, China has opened. China welcomes American capitalists to invest in China to use our cheap labor. And American rich people came to China. They want to make more money. And at the same time, they brought a cheaper price, the good quality stuff to American people to benefit every American. But after a while, those low-tier American consumer,
mm-hmm.
they feel the hurt. Mm-hmm. They lost their job. Therefore, I think they have to blame both Chinese side and also American invest in China. You cannot only blame Chinese side. American investors have the right not to come to China, but they come. And if American buyers would not buy what they outsourced from China, the situation would be different. So in my view, we should understand that under the globalization system, U.S. has the opportunity to use Chinese labor. But if U.S. would consider that China's workers' working condition is not that decent, okay, you move to India. And then India is comparable to China. India's labor is also cheap, and American labor still could not retain their job. Why enjoining cheaper price to India a good stuff? Therefore, I think the Chinese government would not allow to do something to increase too fast the working condition, the salary to our labor, without helping America. Because America investor would go to India, would go to other place, and Americans lost the job would still not return to America. Why we cannot help America and we lose our opportunity?
A little lesson there in globalization. People may not like all the angles of it, but
American strategists and a president would be smart enough that they would pressurize China, but they would be happy if China would making certain concession, but not complete. I think the leadership would appreciate.
Let's get a call from Greenwich, Connecticut, and Richard. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. Boy, do I love this dialogue. We are so completely owned by China that gentleman could talk about us the way we used to talk about China 28, 30 years ago. We thought they were going to be the largest market for America. It turned out the opposite way. And now they own us. And now you have to be very careful of what both your people are talking about. And that is we should concentrate on the income that our people need to be able to sustain themselves. We need jobs. We need the industries here. Outsourcing and using cheap Chinese labor is nonsense, just nonsense. And the investors we need are to invest in this country and to put quotas on the Japanese and Chinese products for a while until we could start building back again. If we don't build, we're dead. And to listen to this is so hard for me as an American age 70-plus, right?
But, Richard, what happens if the U.S. tried that, given that we also depend on Chinese capital flows?
We succeeded at it, and we passed it along. I even wrote something that I took to China 25 years ago that they implemented. It's how to build a productive process. And if you buy cheap stuff from this country called China on an ongoing basis, we will never be able to overcome a recession. We must have our own productive process in at least 16 to 17 new areas. I've outlined them. A lot of people have. We must produce products so we create systematic jobs. No one's working. Not even the rich are working. They're just inheriting the monies and investing. Like Warren Buffett did. He invested in a hybrid auto plant of which the Chinese have tons of. They have a plan for one car in every garage in the world. It's a very comprehensive plan.
But out of China, Richard, we've got the perspective. Anthony Kuhn, you're listening there in Beijing. I wonder what you're thinking as you listen to this last couple of callers. The American problem with employment is very acute right now. This is not a new dynamic, but the economic problems are highlighting it. And you hear the kind of tensions that come to the fore there. What do you say, Anthony?
Well, I completely agree that, you know, the U.S. needs to start rebuilding itself, but it's not going to do it by making widgets for Walmart. The U.S. cannot compete with China, with other Southeast Asian nations, with East European nations. Make no mistake, China's eventually its exports are going to decline, and people are going to be looking for cheap sources of labor elsewhere, but they're not going to find them in countries the size of Vietnam. They just can't compete with China. And India, you know, will move in that direction, but they still need more infrastructure. So I really don't think that the U.S. is competing for these low-end jobs with China. What America is competitive in, is, of course, high-tech, high-value-added and service businesses. And that is why we are a far more powerful exporting nation than China is. So there's no competition there. And the other thing is,
right
now is a trade war. I mean, we got into that, you know, after the Depression and after the stock market crash in 1929 with the Smoot-Hawley tariff. And what happened? Well, our foreign trade really collapsed because we did get into a zero-sum sort of trade war game. And I don't think that's what we need right now.
Anthony, could I turn a corner and ask you for a moment on the political side, how you see the Chinese government, how you imagine it responding to greater economic challenges here, whether through liberalizing, as we've heard discussed a little bit in this hour, or getting tougher on the political front on dissent because of fears about Chinese stability. We read recently about this group called Charter 08, Several hundred Chinese intellectuals and dissidents signing a document calling for more democracy, human rights, rule of law, etc., and a lot of them being interrogated by the Central Propaganda Department in China. How do you see China responding politically to tougher economic times? Liberalization or something else, Anthony?
There is no question that, you know, how well China does at dealing with the coming economic dislocations depends on how it gives people a voice, how it allows people to protect their rights when they're thrown out of work, or when they eat, you know, tainted milk powder, or when they're hit in an earthquake. All the events of 2008 have this component to them. People go out and try and protect their interests and protect their rights, and they run up against the interests of the Chinese state. Now, you know, this Charter 08 was one example, and these intellectuals came out with 19 points modeled on the 1977 Charter in Czechoslovakia, in which they call for an end to, you know, one-party rule, free press, democratic elections, and all that. And essentially, the Chinese government is treating that as a challenge to the Communist Party rule and attempt to subvert the state, and they won't stand for it. This is really crucial to how China will weather the hard times that are sure to come in the next few months. And they are not prepared to give ground on their monopoly of power. But this will also be a very key issue in the bailout. This is the subtext to all of the bailout that's going on. The provinces are going to say, if you don't give us money, our people are going to rise up. The workers are going to be laid off. They're going to smash things as they have. There have been 10 cities which have seen strikes by taxi drivers. There have been, in Guangdong, in the Pearl River Delta, unemployed workers have smashed their factories after the bosses ran away with all the money. So this is a very central concern of the Chinese government is the possibility of unrest because of economic dislocations.
Professor Shen, how do you see that risk? Economic stress leading to social unrest. How big is that risk, and how do you expect the Chinese government will respond to it?
Actually, in the recent years, even without the current economic difficulties, there have emerged already quite some social unrest because of the disparity among the populace.
In income.
Income and in different region, etc. And now, given the current economic difficulty, I think there might emerge more different sorts in the society and in different kind of people and in what you have called the few hundred intellectuals or dissidents. And the government will be very careful in watching and in handling them. And recent Charter 08 is an apparent example. But I also think the government has drawn lots of lessons it has experienced before. And for instance, for the recent cab taxi driver, strike, government has, in each case, in each city where such a protest occurred, government has taken a soft methodology. And to talk to people, to help defray their difficulty, and to ask the company bosses to collect less money from the drivers. And for my city in Shanghai, the taxi driver are quite okay, no social unrest. And then drawing the lesson of other city, my leader talked to our taxi drivers in the first place to ask do you have any difficulty and what we can do to help you. And as government announced that it's going to table out a plan to cut the kind of charge. And that would assure that the Shanghai society would be stable. So government has been careful and also using soft approach in dealing with the tension.
Careful and maybe using a soft approach.
Carrots and sticks.
Yeah, right, carrots and sticks. There's certainly times when the hammer comes down, and it's going to be quite the tiger to ride in this coming year. It's been a fascinating window opened onto the world you're all living in there, and we're grateful to you. Shending Li in Shanghai, thank you very much for being with us this hour, Mr. Shen.
Thank you, Tom.
James Arity with the Wall Street Journal in Shanghai, thanks so much for joining us, James.
Thanks, Tom.
And Anthony Kuhn with NPR in Beijing. Anthony, you're wonderful as always, and thank you very much for your time today.
A pleasure always, Tom. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.